Mr. Calhoun.
Mr. Calhoun, I'm sorry. Mr. Calhoun, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes, certainly. Come on up. We're happy to hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kevin Calhoun, and along with Mr. Charles Cosby here, we represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Michael Maldini. Now, I would just like to say this is my first time appearing before this Court, so it's my honor to be here, and it's a privilege.
Thank you. And Mr. Cosby, you're welcome to join your co-counsel at the table if you would like, sir.
I'd like to start with just a brief summary of this case. This was a rape case where the defense was consent. The defendant testified at trial and said that this whole event was a consensual encounter. I don't think there was really any overwhelming independent evidence to show that this was either consensual or non-consensual. It mainly came down to what the victim said and what the defendant said at trial. So the credibility of both of those parties was incredibly important in the jury's decision. I'd also like to point out that there was a pretrial motion under the Rape Shield statute in this case, and the judge ruled that certain statements made by the victim to the defendant were precluded from coming into trial because they involved prior sexual conduct with someone else other than the defendant. I'd also just like to briefly recall the assignments of error in this case. The first one is that the trial court erred by not allowing the appellant to ask the victim about statements that she made to her roommate. And there was two statements on this first assignment of error. And the first one was whether she was flirting with a sergeant in her unit. But both the victim and the defendant were in the Marines, I believe. And the defendant was a sergeant. And the second statement was whether she told her roommate that she had sex on the night in question, but that it didn't turn out the way she wanted to. So those were the first two questions that were attempted to be asked at trial, but they were refused, and we would assign error to that ruling. And the second issue was whether the
trial... Can I ask you on that first assignment of error?
Yes, Judge.
If the court were to conclude that that was error, mm-hmm. obviously under Virginia statutes, we have to do a harmless error analysis. Mm-hmm. Would we be dealing with constitutional harmless error or non-constitutional harmless error?
I believe, as the Assistant Attorney General pointed out, that this would be a non-constitutional harmless error. And he listed a number of factors that I had planned to go through later in my argument, but I think given the witness that they were attempting to question, being the victim and the main witness in the case, I think that's probably one of the most important factors in the harmless error test here. Also, I think the fact that there was not an incredible amount of corroborating evidence to support her claim. I think there was some testimony that there was a scratch on the appellant's neck, but I think that the appellant explained that that came from a consensual affair, and I think that's reasonable to believe, too. It could have very well came from a consensual encounter, and I think there was one or two other pieces of corroborating evidence, I think, about the appellant maybe having a flushed face when he was confronted with the issue, but I think that could be explained away. But I think with such limited corroborating evidence, being able to ask the victim these questions could have opened up this entire case. I mean, if...
I think the testimony was is that the appellant actually turned pale.
That's correct, Judge.
Flushing when it was brought up by the other Marine officer.
Yes, Judge.
But what about the evidence that, in addition to Ms. Lazorczyk, mm-hmm. The testimony that she gave, what about the evidence and testimony from other Marines that she actually fell out of formation and that was not something she had ever done before when she ran into... The gunnery appellant. Sergeant at a time that perhaps she wasn't expecting to.
Yes, Judge. I think there was some other testimony maybe that she came back from that hospital that day, and I think she wasn't acting like herself. But I think the appellant's position and what he testified to at trial was that She had a romantic interest in him and wanted to pursue that, and he essentially denied that from happening. He said, I can't let this happen. I risk losing my job if we start dating. It would be this fraternization issue that was explained extensively at trial, and so perhaps she was upset from his rejection, especially when she was coming back from the hospital. She could have just been down from being rejected by the defendant. And I think perhaps the same thing at that, I think it was called muster is what they would refer as. I think perhaps that's the same reason. Or maybe she just didn't feel great that day. I mean, maybe she hadn't eaten a big lunch, or she was just feeling weak. Maybe they had gone on a long run that morning. I'm not sure if there's a specific explanation that was brought out at the trial, but I think there could be a reasonable explanation for that.
Counsel, let me ask you about your first assignment of error. Your contention is that the trial, I understand you were not trial counsel, but that the trial judge's failure to allow trial counsel to inquire about the statement to the roommate was a denial of a due process under her Sixth Amendment right to, under her confrontation clause. Did trial counsel preserve that?
I think implicitly they did. In reviewing the transcript, I recall the trial counsel saying, Judge, I think I have a right to cross-examine this witness about this statement, and I think obviously, the confrontation clause, the heart of that is cross-examination. So by putting it in front of the judge that she believes she has a right to cross-examine this witness about those statements, I think to a degree she's invoking the Sixth Amendment by making that statement. I think she's impliedly making it known to the judge that this is a cross-examination issue, which obviously would invoke the confrontation clause.
Is it that, and I submit that I can still cross-examine her with respect to whether or not she said anything of that nature to Mackenzie Reese?
Yes, Judge.
But it doesn't say anything about the confrontation clause. I mean, you could have other reasons why you would say, Your Honor, I ought to be able to cross-examine this witness. It could be for all sorts of reasons, right?
It could be, Judge. I think it certainly could have been more clear. I mean, she could have said it was the Sixth Amendment that I'm challenging this on, but I think implicitly,
confrontation.
Yeah, just confrontation. I mean, I'm not disagreeing that it couldn't have been clear, but I think just implicitly it would have invoked the Sixth Amendment. But I really think the main thing here is the question about the statement about the night in question. I mean, There was no issue about preservation raised there other than that the proffer was insufficient as to what the victim would have said. But and I think the assistant attorney general referred to a case, I think it was Kearney, I believe. But in that case, it was the defendant's attorney on direct examination of his own client where there was an objection, and I don't think he made a proffer at all, and then on an appeal, this court said, we don't know what your client would have said, so we can't go back and overturn the court's decision. But in this case here, this is the defense attorney cross-examining the victim, who he's never talked to before, and while he might have some idea or some hope of what she would say, I don't think there's any way that he can definitely know what she's going to say. And I think what's important is that the trial counsel put on the record, this is what I want to ask her. I mean, the trial counsel clearly preserved what the issue was or the statement was that she wanted to ask. And I think importantly, too, I mean, I think that statement goes to the night in question when she was with the defendant. If the trial counsel could have asked that question and she admitted to making the statement, I think the trial counsel could have delved into, well, what does it mean that it didn't go as planned? And especially when the defendant was going to get on the stand later to testify about how the victim had some kind of romantic interest or wanted this to go on longer than just one night, I think that didn't go as planned could have referred to, I got rejected. I didn't get to keep seeing him. It also could have perhaps led to other questions that the trial attorney could have asked, not just that one question, but other questions about, well, did you have romantic feelings about him? How deep were they? When did you develop them? Did they play a factor in your reporting at all? But I think that's the main issue with our argument today. I'll tell you on the second issue, the second assignment of error, we went back and reviewed the transcripts in the case. We've reviewed the Assistant Attorney General's brief, and I think those points are well taken. I think our argument is that the trial court did err. I think the trial counsel did have a right to contradict the witness with something other than just direct contradictory statements. I think whether it was to show that her recollection was or her perception was skewed or maybe that she had made some other kind of statement to someone else, I think they could have questioned that. But by putting, I think it was Detective Parsons on the stand, I think he kind of addressed all of the questions and kind of cured that error. So I think with y'all's permission, we wouldn't really focus on that one, just mostly on
sure.
this first issue.
I appreciate your candor on that with the court, too.
So, and just briefly on going back to the flirting issue, I think being able to question the victim on whether she had been flirting with the sergeant, who the defendant is the sergeant, the Assistant Attorney General brings up the quote from the Montana Supreme Court about how flirting isn't relevant to consent. And I don't think we're up here arguing that flirting is consent by any means, but I think it can lead to a consensual sexual encounter. I think our argument is that flirting is the natural first step to a consensual relationship. I mean, first you start talking with someone, maybe you start flirting with them, you go out on a couple dates, and then there's a consensual sexual relation. I think it's the rare occasion where there's just no flirting ahead of time, and you just ask someone to have sex. So I think the flirting can be relevant, and I think it would have been relevant in this case. And I think also that the argument would be that flirting would not be sexual conduct either. There's no touching, there's no intercourse, there's no kissing even. It just would have been teasing or flirting. So, see, I've reached my time. So
sorry, we'll save your time for rebuttal. You've got nearly 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. I guess the issues are now down to one issue, and that is whether the trial court committed reversible error with regards to the victim's cross-examination. Our answer to that would be no. As the Court is aware, that the first assignment of error deals with two alleged statements that the victim allegedly made to her roommate. And to begin with the question that was asked at trial of the victim, and that question was, did you tell your roommate that you had been flirting with a sergeant in your unit? And the victim in the case said no. And then there was an objection based on Rape Shield. And I think the context is important here because prior to trial, we had this Rape Shield hearing in which one of the rulings was that the defense could not put on evidence that the victim had told the defendant that she had sex with a Sergeant Norman. And I think what the trial court interpreted this question to be was related to that prior hearing on the matter.
And that may well be, but then on page 516 of the joint appendix, defense counsel Ms. McGee says, Your Honor, I just want to make it clear that the proffer where I was going on that was not anything about the relationship with anyone else. And the court says, I understand. Yeah. And she says, which I took to be the subject of the denial of the motion in limine. So she is distinguishing the point you just made, oh, maybe it was Sergeant Norman, as opposed to being with appellant here.
Right.
And
right.
She goes, but with respect to the relationship between my client and Ms. Lazorchak as to what happened that night of February 7th on her initial report to her roommate.
Yeah, so there is some clarification with that exchange between defense counsel and the trial court, and I will acknowledge that. But there was never any argument that has been raised on appeal in either at the time of the objection or in this later exchange that this was not covered by the rape shield because flirting is not sexual conduct.
What about the second statement? Wouldn't that go show a consensual encounter that wouldn't be covered by the rape shield hearing because it's the actual act in question of that night?
The second statement about whether we had sex and it didn't turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Turn out the way I wanted.
Right.
If there was an argument that this was not rape shield, perhaps that it wouldn't be covered under the rape shield statute. But our argument with that is that there was an inadequate proffer.
Okay, that's what
first and foremost.
How do you respond to Mr. Calhoun's statement, though, that, well, we're cross-examining her. We don't really know how she's going to respond because she's not air witness.
No, I understand that. I'm sorry I don't have a citation in front of me, but I've certainly researched this issue, and even in cross-examination, you have to make the proffer. There's a number of cases, and I wish I had a cite that I could just give to you, but even in cross-examination, you must proffer the question you want to ask and that expected answer. And she was not denied any opportunity to do this. In fact, after she had this exchange that we just talked about, there was another proffer of another matter. So there was certainly the opportunity to proffer outside the presence of the jury what the expected answer would have been. And I think it is incumbent because it's very difficult for this court to engage in any sort of harmless error. Even if this didn't fall under the rape shield and this was error, it's very hard for us to engage in any sort of harmless error analysis. The Commonwealth wasn't given the opportunity to explain why she may have said that or what context was this question asked. There was some indication in the record that this roommate, who, by the way, was not subpoenaed for trial, that she was the first to notice there was something wrong on the night in question. So I don't know if it was a situation where she was asking, is there something wrong? And then she just said,
roommate lived in Baltimore with her, though, right? This wasn't her roommate during the Marine weekend, reservist weekend, right? Mackenzie Reese.
I don't know. I assumed it was the roommate. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Because this
wasn't clear from the record.
It wasn't clear to me, at least to the record. Maybe counsel, opposing counsel has some insight on that. I knew though that night though she went out with some people, to the Super Bowl get together, and then I was assuming that she came back. I don't know if she came back to Baltimore or what, but I just don't know. Circling back, I mean, with regards to the flirting question, we know that she denied it. Let's say for the sake of argument that the trial court erred in sustaining the objection for rape shield purposes. We know that she denied making it because she said, no, I did not tell my roommate that. This roommate was not subpoenaed, and we do not have her testimony to impeach the victim on this collateral matter. There's also no evidence that the person that they're talking about with regards to flirting was the defendant. It's just a sergeant. We don't know if that's the defendant or who that is. Obviously, as we've opposing counsel brought up, flirting is not consent. I did a little bit of research on this issue, and I found the Montana case that I cite in my brief, and there's just a few others, I think, other places where they've tried to determine whether or not flirting is covered under the rape shield. And most of the time, from my research, is that the courts have said that it's not sexual conduct, but it's not relevant. And it's just,
what about the second statement? Because really the defense in this case is consent. And it seems like it could be significant to the defendant's position if the victim in the case, if they had evidence that the victim in the case told someone, I had sex, but it didn't turn out the way I wanted.
Well, certainly that is not inconsistent with her version of events, is that there was sex. They both said there was sex. It's not an untrue statement.
Okay.
It is not a statement that says, I went to have sex with this guy, and it just didn't work out the way I mean, it was, you can read that as a statement that I had sex, didn't turn out the way I want, and she just didn't want to talk about what happened because she had been raped.
So your position would be that even if it was error, it would be harmless error, but you don't believe it was error at all to sustain the objection?
Yes. With regards to that second statement, we would argue that there's not an adequate proffer for us to reach it. If the court would say that there is an adequate proffer to reach the issue, I guess there's two possibilities. She would have either said, yes, this happened, or no, which we don't have the roommate to come in and impeach her on that. If she says yes, then we would argue that, it would be a harmless error.
Okay.
And it would be, do you agree with Mr. Calhoun that it would be a non-constitutional harmless error analysis?
I believe so. I will say, though, that this court in Carnes, which they cite on brief, evaluated this issue with a constitutional harmless error.
Evaluated where? It just said cross-examination.
Cross-examination was a constitutional error. It was my understanding that it would be non-constitutional error because it's an evidentiary matter. But
it would be harmless under that standard is just a lot of other evidence. Is that essentially your argument? Overwhelming evidence of
overwhelming evidence of guilt. And I want to make sure I'm making a distinction between the two statements. Flirting, definitely. I don't think that's really, I think that's a very collateral matter. I don't think I think there's overwhelming evidence that the victim's credibility was bolstered by the physical evidence in this case, her demeanor, the defendant's reactions when this post the rape, those sorts of things. I think. Certainly, I think that is harmless under a non-constitutional or constitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. With the second issue, if we get to a harmless error, if they can overcome the procedural hurdles that I think that they have to overcome, then certainly that is a closer issue, I think, than the flirting. But I still think, given the overwhelming evidence in this case, that that statement in itself would not have affected the victim's credibility in a significant amount enough to overturn this on appeal. Unless there are other questions, I would just ask that the court affirm the judgment below.
Thank you very much.
Thank
no
you.
Further questions. And Mr. Calhoun, you have about not quite 3 minutes left if you'd like to rebut.
Yes, Judge, just briefly, on the Assistant Attorney General's argument that the rape shield exception argument was waived because it wasn't specifically argued, when I was reviewing the annotations in the 2018 rule book, the very first annotation says that the primary purpose of the rule is to give the trial court an opportunity to intelligently consider the issue. I think there's no doubt in anyone's mind that the rape shield statute was the issue. The question is whether flirting fell within the statute or not. I think the trial judge clearly knew that these statements involve flirting. So I think in making his decision, he was thinking, is flirting something that's prescribed by the statute? And there's two instances where flirting is brought to his attention. In the question itself, the trial counsel asked, did the victim tell her friend that she had been flirting with a sergeant in her group? So the trial judge must have heard the question about flirting. And even if maybe he didn't hear that and just assumed that it was just statements about sexual conduct, At the bench conference, when the trial counsel comes up, she reiterates that this is flirting. She presents it again. This is the victim's statement that she is flirting. So on two occasions, the trial court gets to hear that this is flirting and not something about sexual conduct. So I think it was well in his mind when he was making his decision. And I think the Assistant Attorney General briefly hit on the fact...
Can I stop you real quick on that? Because sure. On the second part, Ms. McGee had mentioned that she had been flirting, as you said, with an older member of the unit, either a sergeant or something, and that when she came home that night, she said, "We had sex, but it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to." So that's more at that time than just talking about flirting, right?
It is, Judge, but I think maybe she could have separated the two to make it more clear that these were two separate questions that she was asking. One was about flirting, which is not sexual conduct, and then the second one is about the night in question, which is just category excluded from the definition of prior sexual conduct. I think she kind of lumped those together, and perhaps the trial judge kind of just assumed it was one big question. And then just briefly, the Assistant Attorney General mentioned about the friend not being subpoenaed for trial. The victim could have admitted that that's what she said, and we could have gone down that whole path. And I don't think you necessarily need to subpoena someone to call them as a witness. I mean, maybe she was there and she just wasn't under subpoena, and she could have impeached. So just ask that you reverse the conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel will come down and greet you.